As in, with every Dharma talk, or Dharma action, or Dharma session, it's very, very important for us to train up our minds. Thanks. Rather than the problems. It's very, very important to train up our minds to create a positive motivation from the outset. If we create a positive motivation from the outset, our actions will be multiplied. If we create a positive motivation from the outset, our fruitioning of our actions will be much, much more. If we simply do an action and we don't create a higher motivation, a motivation at the level of a bodhisattva, not that we are a bodhisattva, but to create a bodhisattva motivation, then it's very difficult that the action itself has great impact or has great effect. So what's important is the reason we need to make a motivation all the time, and if we find it difficult to make a motivation, that's the very reason we need to make a motivation, because it has to arise spontaneously. When a good motivation doesn't arise spontaneously, it shows us that our mind is preoccupied with a different type of habituation. So when our mind's occupied with a different type of habituation, it's very, very hard for us to make a good motivation. So the mind has one space. Just for a rough example, that space can be occupied by A or B. A and B is very, very difficult. A or B. So therefore, A is good motivation, B is bad motivation. So therefore, what's important is we fill our space with A. How do we do that? When our space is usually filled with B through habituation, when we put A into it, good motivation, and we do it again and again and again, we consciously do it, we consciously focus on it, we consciously make it happen. Although in the beginning, it may seem superficial, but after a while, you will find that it becomes easier and easier and easier and easier. Whether it is superficial or not depends on the effort we put into it. How much we are able to do it, how much we're able to do practice, how much we're able to transform, how much we are able to bring benefit, how much we're able to embrace spiritual practice is dependent on how much we are ready to give up of our selfish mind. If our selfish mind is very strong, then it's very hard to give up. Why? Actions contrary to the Dharma, we don't need to label it positive or negative. Actions contrary to the Dharma is against universal truth. When it's against universal truth, there's no one punishing, or no one saying you're good, or no one saying you're bad, or no one putting you in a box, but you automatically create the type of action that create the same type of result. Remember, my favorite line is, action resembles the result. So therefore, if we do actions contrary to Dharma, if we speak contrary to Dharma, if we act contrary to Dharma, and when I say Dharma, it's different than in a monastery than here. Here, contrary to the Dharma takes a completely different meaning than in a monastery. Completely. Many, many, many great teachers in the monastery, the way they act in the monastery and the way they act outside of the monastery is very different. And the reason is simple. Very, very simple. If you live in a very cold climate, if you go to a warm climate, you're going to change your clothes. So they say, oh, why are you not consistent? Why are your clothes changing? Or why are your clothes different? Why is it not consistent? It's not that you're consistent or not consistent. It's the environment. So therefore, many teachers, when they leave the monastery, they're quite, quite different. Even very conservative teachers in the monastery are very, very different when they leave the monastery. I saw that in the example of the Sultan's Kajah Sovereignty, who is extremely conservative. Very, very, one of the most stalwart conservative lamas I've ever met. So therefore, it's not a contradiction, it's a skillful means. Skillful means. So therefore, how much we are really to give up, and the word give up is very negative. The word give up is negative. Give up actually means you lose something. And when you say you lose something, it's also very negative, because losing something in English has a connotation of you have something and you don't have it anymore. So when we even use the wrong words, because we are attached to words, then we also get caught up in the words that we are attached to. Therefore, when we say give up, it's a very negative connotation. When we say renounce, it's a different connotation also. Actually, renounce means to give up. But to give up and renounce doesn't mean to give up happiness. It means to give up the methods that bring you to unhappiness. So if you're presented with the methods that give you happiness, and you say, oh, I can't accept it, or I can't do it, or I can't engage in it, actually you're not giving up. What happens is this, is that the methods that we have are not methods that are inherently positive or inherently brings us to a happy state of mind. And hence, daily we feel happy, we feel unhappy, we feel disturbed, we feel not disturbed. And as time goes on, as sickness catches on, as age goes on, as our body starts to deteriorate, the unhappiness increases. It definitely increases. So what happens is, when we accept the Dharma path, we say renounce. Renounce actually refers to the methods that bring unhappiness to ourselves and the people around us. So if we say the word give up, if we say the word renounce, like here gave up his monk vows, if we say the word renounce or we say the word give up, it's actually to ordinary people, they'll think, oh yeah, I have to give up. I have to give up something. I have to give up something to gain something. I have to give up something to be spiritual. I have to give up something to adopt a path. That's wrong view. That's totally wrong view. Why is that wrong view? What we are not ready for is not Dharma or giving up or not giving up. What we're not ready for is for our ego to be destroyed. As long as our ego is not destroyed, what is ego? There's many definitions, but let me give you a simple one. Simple definition of ego is the mind that cherishes oneself more than others. When the mind that cherishes oneself more than others, the ego is very strong. Every action that we do, we feed it. When we feed the ego, when we feed this mind through lack of awareness for others, through not carrying out responsibility, through not keeping promises, through not keeping commitments, or not putting in effort, or giving up in another sense, meaning not able to have patience enough to go through difficulties, that's giving up, that's a different type of giving up. When we do those actions, what happens is, we can explain it away to the people around us and to our friends and all that, and they're probably at our level, so they'll accept and understand. But the truth of the matter is, we actually feed the ego even more. So when we feed the ego very much and more, the very actions, the very reason we cannot give up becomes the very reason for us to suffer even more and create the karmic circumstances for other people around us to suffer even more. So therefore, that concept is not very hard to understand. It is not very hard to understand. It is something that we are not used to hearing. It's something we're not used to hearing. But when we hear it, whether we accept it at this moment or engage it at this moment or not, we remain. We remain and we listen and we contemplate and we think, because deep down inside, we feel that it resonates with something. We feel that it is true, that it does make sense. Because if I was to say to you something very negative, most people would get up and leave. But when we say things of this kind of nature to people, they don't get up and leave. They may or may not accept at that moment, but something inside resonates with them and say, wait, that makes sense. And that's what keeps us in the Dharma. That's what keeps us in spiritual practice. That's what keeps us in pushing ourselves towards spiritual practice, because these words resonate. And it also matches what we have done with our lives. What we have done. Not being aware is a facet of the self-cherishing mind. People, whatever they do, if you think about it, whatever they do, the very basis of anyone doing any action, from going to the toilet, from taking a nap, from getting dressed, from going out, from conversations with associating with friends, whatever action that they do is to bring themselves some kind of happiness or some kind of relief. That is the ultimate motivation. From the smallest ant on the ground who create anthills to the supposedly the highest form of intelligence ourselves. Every action we do, we don't need to think about it, we don't need to generate it. I want happiness for myself. I want something for myself. I want to gain something for myself. That is the basic, fundamental, automatic thought that we have. What happens is, if we meditate, or if we focus and we think about that, it doesn't bring us happiness, what we've been doing. And we may call it diverse, or different, or hobbies, or passions, or we can label it anything we want. It's just a label. Label means that it itself doesn't exist on its own from its own side. Exists from itself from its own side doesn't mean the action doesn't exist. It means the reason for the action and the result of the action doesn't exist. So therefore, that action is empty of existence. Please listen very carefully. When we want to steal from someone, the very motivation of stealing from someone is to gain some kind of happiness. But that stealing from someone is empty of existence. Why? It's empty of existence because the reason for it will not bear fruit. The very reason you engage in that action will not bear fruit. Meaning, to have peace, to have happiness, to have wealth, to have respect. So if we cannot get the result of that action, and we engage in that action, in Buddhism, on this level, we call it empty of its existence. So please listen carefully. Empty of its existence doesn't mean that the action doesn't exist. It doesn't mean the person or the doer or the receiver or the recipient doesn't exist. It means that the motivation for the action and the reason for the action and the outcome, that's the secret, the outcome we want for the action is empty of existence. Why? Because when the method is incorrect, the result cannot arise. So therefore, when we engage in spiritual practice, it is hard, it is difficult. The harder it is, the more difficult it is, shows us how strong our ego is. It shows us how incredibly strong our selfish mind is. However strong our selfish mind is how hard spiritual practice will be. Why is that? Because you're going against your normal habituations for a long, long time. So people will find spiritual practice very difficult. If people even like listen to spiritual practice, it's very difficult to listen or focus or stay awake. It shows you that you're going against your grain. There are many people, if you check it out, if you feel tired during a Dharma talk, and you find it difficult for 1 or 2 hours, but if you put yourself in another situation, whatever situation you're in for 1 or 2 hours, if you listen, you find it difficult, then it's consistent. But if you find some situations, it's very easy, and some situations very different, it's purely habituation. It's not good or bad or evil or not. Purely habituation. So in that way, we can track our mind. In that way, we can track the way our mind forces us to become its slave. So therefore, if we find it very difficult to read Dharma books, but we find it very easy to read fashion magazines, for example, very easy to flip through it, very easy to look through it, and we're intensely reading it, if we find that, reading is reading, words is words, meaning is meaning. Why is one meaning difficult and the other meaning not difficult? So that's how we can check our mind. To say, oh, we don't have time to read, or we can't read, or I'm not really a reader, or I'm not able to read. Those are, we have to check if our mind is consistent. Is consistent or not. So if our mind's consistent, in all forms of reading, and maybe we're even illiterate, that's a different story, but most likely it's not the case. So the important thing is this, is if we come across a difficulty, make it simple. It is difficult because we have not pushed ourselves towards that direction. If we don't push ourselves toward that direction, we may be losing out something very great. In the sense of spiritual practice, some people can go through tremendous spiritual hardships and difficulties, tremendous throughout their lives. One obstacle after another, one suffering after another, one letdown, one disillusionment after another. Yet, they don't ever stop practicing. But for them, for worldly things, maybe if they try business, or maybe they try cooking, or maybe they try fishing, and they're not successful after a few times, they give up. Why do they give up? Because their habituation is not towards that. Some people, when it's toward Dharma practice, they give up very easy. But towards fishing or entertainment or singing or laying around or having a good time, they don't give up easy. Why don't they give up easy? Because that's a clear indication of the state of their mind. Again, what I want you to get out of the framework is it's criticism. It's not, I'm giving you a guideline. I'm giving you a guideline to check. It may seem like criticism to some people who's guilty, self-guilty of the action, so they feel uncomfortable, but it's not criticism for me. Why? It's presentation of information. Presentation of incredible information that we can use as a guideline for our lives, for our relationship, for what we want to accomplish and for the people around us. Therefore, if we always find something difficult, and I'm talking about, in this case, spiritual practice, then that can be very dangerous for us. Why? The mind can make many types of excuses, justifications, covers, and fears to not engage in spiritual practice. Not engage. Or while we're engaging, it's not sincere and real. And then our mind is distracted, and we make our time up by substituting with other things that make the time go away. So the important factor here is we must examine our minds. We must confront our minds. We must face our minds. If we don't face our minds, the people we feel secure around will one day be gone. That is for sure. That is definitely for sure. The people we feel secure around will one day be gone. Or we've gone before them. If we don't confront our minds, the very opportunity we have in front of us at this time, health, can be gone. The very opportunity we have in front of us, such as a Dharma center, can be gone. Dharma centers have closed. Great monasteries have been destroyed. Great teachers die. Great masters get killed. So when we have the great opportunity in front of us and we don't engage in it, what we need to do is, what I was told by my teacher was, to in fact meditate and contemplate, truly contemplate and meditate on the impermanence of everything around us. Whatever we are attached to, whatever we want to escape to, whatever we want to hold on to, whatever it is, we have to concentrate on its impermanence. Why? Because it's the truth. Impermanence is the truth that cannot be taken away by any philosophy, any religion, or any one. You see, there are philosophical points or methods, that's a better word, philosophical methods that different religions can debate on with each other. And the debate goes on. But there are ultimate truths, such as impermanence, that no one can debate on. That no one can take away, and no one can demean, or no one can say it doesn't exist. So those are the universal truths that Buddhism likes to focus on. It's not debatable. You want to debate, you can, but it will be only one conclusion. If you talk about meditating on Buddha or Jesus, there are many debates, and that debate has no conclusion. It's either or, no problem. But when you talk about impermanence, to apply to making ourselves feel an urgency not to lose a chance, that one's not debatable. Why? Why is it not debatable? Because it's a truth that encompasses all cultures, all people, all races, and time. So we meditate, if we meditate on impermanence, that the person we're very attached to, because usually in life it's people, it's money, it's entertainment, those are the things that we're usually attached to. Most of us. Attached meaning what? Let me give you the definition of attached. Attached meaning we feel that this person, this situation, this activity will secure us with what we want in life. That if we have this person, if we have this activity, if we have this action, we are secure. Hence, when we feel that, think about it, when we feel that and we engage in it, we're still insecure. The person we're with might be taken away by someone else. The person we're with, the mood might change, the thoughts might change. Our karma with that person might end. We ourselves may not like that person anymore, or the person might be separated by sickness or death or other reasons. And so when any of these reasons arise for us to be separated from that person, we suffer tremendously. Why do we suffer tremendously? Because we've held on to this person as security and permanent. And that's where the suffering comes. So people blame the person. It's not the person. It's our projection of the person. We have to think about that. So therefore, if we're attached to some activity, such as frivolous entertainment, and we're very attached to it. Attached again means what? Thinking that this activity brings us secure, constant, non-stop happiness. If we're attached to it, that's the definition of attachment. So don't take it as a negative connotation, take it as just an explanation of how the mind works. When we are attached to frivolous entertainment, that moment we feel peace, but we find that we gain less and less and less and less and less peace, less and less security, less and less respect, less and less achievements. Why is that? Because frivolous entertainment take us away from achieving our work, achieving our assignment, achieving our goals, achieving our spiritual practice, achieving our manifestation of love for people we love, for example, our parents, our partners. It takes away from it. Why? If we engage our time in frivolous entertainment again and again, it is not negative in itself, but its repercussions are negative. Why? It takes away from something else that we can accomplish, that would gain us respect, that would gain us love, that would gain us friends, that would gain us inverted commas, samsaric security of some level. So when we are frivolous, just very simple, if we're supposed to do an assignment or we're supposed to do something for work and we don't, and we're sitting there staring at the sky, we're imagining things, we're watching TV, we're surfing on the net, we're running around with friends, we're gossiping, you know, we're doing these kind of things, the action we're supposed to do, we don't get to do, and when we actually get to it, we do it very fast, haphazardly, as quick as possible, or we altogether forget. So what's the repercussions of that is very clear. Our bosses and friends and our co-workers will not respect us. We lose respect for ourselves. It's only so much we can hide. It's only for so long we can hide. That is just an example that we can apply to everything. So when we're attached to frivolous activity, the frivolous activity, watching videos and surfing the net and running around and talking, gossiping, and going out to eat and all that, those itself is not negative. Those itself are actually neutral. What makes it positive or negative is the results that it bears for us and others. So what makes it negative is the result that it bears for ourselves and others. So how, if people ask, how do I know if that's good or bad? Look at the results. Look at the results. That's very, very simple. How do we know, example in this one, it says, how do we know if the Lama's action is good or bad? Look at his senior students. Look at their mind. Look at their level. Look how they think. Look how hard they work. Look how devoted they are. Look at how they change their lives and other people's lives. So how do we know if a Lama's action is good or bad if we're confused? We look at the senior students. We look at the results of it. We look at how other monks react or other teachers react. We see how the students react. We see those actions as a result of whether our Lama's actions are good or bad. So I'll get back to that because that talks about unconventional methods number two, as Joe has put here. So the important thing is this is, if we use any labels to not engage in Dharma practice, if we use any labels to not engage in Dharma practice, then let's make it very simple and let's make it very direct. The people we love, we actually don't love. The people that we love, we actually don't love. And that stems back from Shantideva's Bodhisattva Chanamantara. If we don't engage in spiritual practice, we don't love the people we love, although we say we love them. Why? There is ultimate love, and there is ego love. Ego love is, this person gives me security, this person helps to distract me, this person helps me to make my time go away easier, this person helps me to relieve my stress. It's always about me, 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 me. So what happens, in fact, with this person, we create even more negative karma. We create even more negative affinity. So that's why certain people we meet in life after life after life after life after life. Even in certain situations, if our relationship is very pleasant with a person, if we look at it on a very superficial level, yes, it's a result of good karma. But think now. For a lot of you, we can go to the next level now. If we think about it carefully, a very pleasant relationship is very dangerous. Why? It takes us away from spiritual practice. If that's not the case, Buddha would not have become a monk. We think about that. So if we have a very pleasant relationship, the key is, of course we can stay in the relationship, but we must stay in the relationship with awareness of this truth. So that we will engage in spiritual practice to ultimately help the person and ourselves. And that's why I always stress, if you love your mother, if you love your father, if you love your friends and you love the people who are kind to you, you will engage in spiritual practice. That's why I told many people for many years. A lot of people look at it on a very superficial level. Oh, I make offerings to my mother, I dedicate for my mother, I help my mother. It's very good, but that's very superficial and that doesn't go very far. If you really love your mother, if you really love your father, if we really love our teachers and our friends and our Dharma brothers and sisters and people all around us, if we really love them, do you know how you love them? By doing what Shakyamuni did. Confronting your attachments. Why did Shakyamuni leave the palace? Why did Shakyamuni at such a young age give up his beauty, his hair, his clothes, his ornaments, his kingdom, his life, his position, his fabulous wife, his beautiful son, his dancing girls, his mother, his father, his food, his palace, his servants, the walls, the riches? Why did he give all that up? Openly, directly, for a normal mind, it looks like he gave up. He didn't give up. He didn't give up at all. In fact, he loved them so much, he went to do something about his love. Just like Jesus Christ. Just like Jesus. Lord Buddha loved so much. And how did he love? He developed that level of bodhisattva where it was his last lifetime. It was absolutely his last lifetime that he will be in samsara, uncontrolled. Supposedly. Alright? Uncontrolled. Let me use that for convenience. Because he loved his mother and father and all the mother and fathers he's had in his previous lives. And his wife, his sons, his servants, his attendants, he loved everyone so much defense attachments. And with so much obstacles, from his parents, and his obstacles weren't just 1 year or 2 years, it was from the time of his birth they protected him and avoided him from seeing the truth and the sufferings and the difficulties and of human existence, old age and sickness and separation. They separated him from that. They avoided him from seeing that. They did everything they can to stop that. But because his imprints were so strong, with so much obstacles, if it was in our case, imagine. Just imagine. Imagine Lim Tak Ming. You surround him with 900 beautiful dancing girls, voluptuous, and then we say, go be a monk. Maybe it would be very hard. Very, very hard. Imagine Koki. We fill the room with Dharma books and pizza. And we still go be a monk. Oh yeah, it's got air conditioning too. Think about it. It sounds like a joke, but all of us have these attachments. I do too. If we pile the room with lots and lots of money, FDs and gold bricks and diamonds, and it's just filled with all this money. Filled. And it's overwhelmed with money. Just it's just tremendous. You know, you can't get away from the money. And since he psychically knows he's going to be picked, Joseph, he's psychic. Because he's sitting there going, he's a good sport. He's a very good sport. Really is a good sport. But he has to be a good sport because he wants to be enlightened. So we have to get our mind away from, I like this, I don't like this. Lamas tease students to death. They stop when it doesn't bother them anymore. The lamas are very kind. To put themselves in people's view as nasty. They break their conventions. And people question, why is the lama so nasty? The lamas are very kind to put themselves in that light open. So therefore, if you put Joseph in a room full of money and FDs and gold, that's the same attachment as the videos and the pizza and the books. Why is Koki's inverted commas attachment bigger than inverted commas Joseph's? Attachment is attachment. It's what keeps us away from spiritual practice. One is not worse than the other. So if you keep a room full of that and you tell Joseph, oh, go be a monk, give up everything. Give up, that's a negative connotation. Renounce. Quite hard. That's why we respect monks and we fold our hands to monks and we support monks. We don't say negative things about them. We don't put them down. We don't slice them up. We don't criticize them because we have never reached that level where we can give up anything. So even if you have a monk that's negative, inverted commas, bad, you seem a little fat, you seem a little greedy, they don't meditate as much, they're still better than you. They're still better. They're still much better than you. That's what the older monks tell us when we're in a monastery. You don't look at the few vows that they damaged. You look at the vows that they haven't damaged. That's much more. 253 to be exact. So if they damage two or three vows, they still have 240 plus. That's more than you will ever be able to even think about them doing. So therefore, Lord Buddha loved everyone so much. He renounced. And look what happened. Look how much benefit he brought to the world for thousands of years. That is an example that inspires me. That is an example that we should learn to be inspired by. We shouldn't be inspired by any example lower than that. And I'll tell you why. Because we've all along been inspired by examples lower than that. Our whole lives, our previous lives. But look where we are still. We're still confused. We still get thrown off. We still give up. We still feel angry. We still feel happy. We still feel exuberated. We still feel totally depressed. Those are all the same sides of two sides of a coin. Two sides of a coin. So therefore, Lord Buddha showed us by example how he loved all sentient beings. So if we want to follow a certain percentage of what Lord Buddha did, because we have taken refuge and we believe in Lord Buddha, or we believe in human qualities. You know, not even Buddhist per se, human qualities. We really believe in that. If we believe, we will start with the very people we love. We will start with the very people that have been kind to us, before and current, by engaging in spiritual practice. People feel that if you engage in spiritual practice, you don't spend time with this person, you don't do this with this person, you don't give them this, you don't give them that, that you are selfish, you are uncaring, and you're not nurturing. That's wrong view. Then Buddha was uncaring and unnurturing. Don't talk about he didn't spend time with his wife and kid, he said, see you later. And in fact, he ran away in the middle of the night. If you did that today, how would they look at the husband? Imagine the husband in the middle of the night get into his car and speeds away into the forest. Think about it. But how come it's okay for Buddha to do that, but if a normal guy does that today, it's not okay? Think about it. Why is it if a guy gets in his car, packs up his bags, and then his driver takes him out, if he has a driver, because Buddha had a charioteer driver, and then when he reaches a certain point, he says bye-bye. And then why is that looked upon as negative? But when Buddha did that, we go, wow, he's so renounced. He's so fabulous. I want to do that. I pray to do that. Why? Let me make it simple. Motivation and goal. Motivation and goal. So we're getting our car to say goodbye to our wife, bye-bye in the middle of the night because we're going to our mistress. No one's going to go money. No one. If we're getting in the car because we're a loser and we can't support our wife, we can't support our kids because we're a loser and we don't push ourselves to be a winner and we get in the middle of the car to drive back somewhere else to disappear, no one goes, oh, money, they're at home. No one. So the action is the same. Today, a husband gets in a car and says, see you later, wife, see you later, kids, see you later, lover, see you later, whoever. Why don't anybody fold their hands and say wonderful? Because the motivation is different. You think about it. It makes total sense. But when Buddha left his wife, when Buddha left his kids, we glamorize it. We talk about it. We write about it. We carve it on the Borobudur stupas in Indonesia. We draw tankas of it. We write books on it. We write scriptures on it. We recite it. We admire it. We praise it. We recount it. We share it with our children. Buddha left his kids. Buddha left his wife. Buddha left his parents. Buddha left them. We share it, we love it, we fold our hands to it, we prostrate to the man who abandoned his family and his parents. Think about it. That's what he did. He gave up everything. He renounced. And yet, we're sitting there prostrating to him. Why do we prostrate to something that we don't admire? Of course we have to prostrate to something we admire, because deep down inside we know what we need to do. We know what we need to do. And if we don't do it, I'm not going to tell you a Dharma protector is going to get you because they won't. I'm not going to tell you that it's bad karma because it's not that directly. What I'm going to tell you is you're asking for trouble. Why are you asking for trouble? Because the trouble and the energy for trouble will build up. How will it build up? How can actions coming out of the ego bring good results? Do you want to fill the lake with more toxins? Or with fresh water, eventually it will flush out the toxins. Do you want to fill your body with more toxins or fresh water to flush out the toxins? Obviously, you must put in fresh water. Similarly, if we keep feeding the ego and keep feeding with more toxins and negative actions that are motivated by the self-cherishing mind, how can your mind be happy or bring happiness to others? Please think. You're here for 2-3 hours. Use this time, open your mind and think. Think, utilize this moment, and think very hard. Why do we admire the actions of Lord Buddha and what he did? Whereas in today's terms, it would be considered very bad. Motivation. Totally motivation. Totally the end. So therefore, if we love our husbands and wives, if we love the children that we have, if we got or don't got, if we love our parents, if we love our friends, if we love anyone, and by the way, The ultimate one is if we love ourselves, we will engage in spiritual practice. We will engage. Why will we engage in spiritual practice? We say we work very hard because we love other people. We give up our time and energy because we love other people. So if we love other people so much and that we can do so much, why wouldn't we want to do something even more than just money and house and company and security and entertainment and watching TV? Wouldn't we want to do something more if we truly love them? So that's how we examine. Do we really love another person? Do we really love the people that are kind to us? Or we're actually using them? Using them is harsh, but I don't mean it in a harsh way. Are we using them? If we are using our parents, using our lovers, using our husbands and wives, and using our co-workers around us, then we will not be motivated to do spiritual practice. Why is that? Because when we don't gain attainments, when we don't cut the self-cherishing line, when we keep engaging in activities that make us deeper and deeper and deeper in activities that feed the self-cherishing mind, how can that be love? How can that be love? It's actually using others, using situations. So why do I say that? Why do I say that? It relates directly to what Jigme Trungpa Rinpoche is teaching us in this book. So therefore, people say, oh, I need to spend time with I hear that for the last 15, 20 years. I need to spend time with my wife. I need to spend time with my husband. Wonderful. 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 And the more you spend time with them, that's wonderful. But ultimately, what do they get? What do you get? What do they get? And what do you get? And when you see your partner's life ebbing away and they're dying, what can you do for them? Even holding their hands brings no benefit anymore. They can't feel it. Or if you're going away, your life is ebbing away, and their partner's looking at you, you create even more suffering for them. Because in your life, if you've done nothing to benefit others and you've done more negative actions, you create more suffering in your partner. Why? Because your partner will be very worried for you. Very worried for your rebirth. Very worried for what's going to happen to you. Why is that? They may have been patient with the way you acted during your life, but in death, the truth comes out. So you create more suffering with your partner. So therefore, what's my point? These words are poignant. They're very strong. But they're the truth. Everything that I talked about right now that has nothing to do with you praying, meditating, chanting mantras, kowtowing, offering incense, that's not the religion that I teach. Everything here I'm teaching you is every human being can think and examine and use their brain. The type of dharma I like is use your brain one. Not listen to gossip, not listen to criticism, not listen to negative talk, not listen to talk that drag you down or make you confused or make you feel even more unhappy. That's the kind of dharma I like. And sometimes when we give that type of dharma, it must be dispensed at the level of the person and their karma. For example, a skillful lama who knows that if a person does this action, the results will be like this and this and this and this later. And they have tremendous compassion for their friend or their student. They may ask the friend and student, hey, please engage in this practice, do prostrations, or go do vajrasattva, or go do 35 confessionals, and do that for a certain amount of time. Why? After they finish the confession of vajrasattva, they may not feel anything, but it avoids from that karma, from accumulating, growing big, and getting them back years later. So the lama is very kind. The lama is very kind because they know, they understand. Either by studying the scriptures or clairvoyantly. Either way. There are some lamas who are clairvoyant, they know what's going to happen to people a few years later. Some lamas are not clairvoyant, some lamas are very well read in scriptures, so they know that if you do this, actually this result will come. Because the Buddha has stated clearly about karma, as best as we can comprehend it. So therefore, the Lama may say, you do this, you do this, you do this. And then the person say, oh, I did my setra. Hey, I did my prostration, but I'm still out of a job. I'm still unhappy. I'm still angry. I'm still not doing well. Like a little tagline I read recently on a sticket. I drink green tea, I light candles, and I meditate, but I still want to slap you. Don't you like that? I think that's great. It kind of sums up our spiritual practice. Something along that lines. So therefore, sometimes the Lama knows that if this action that you do is very negative, it will bring many negative effects to that person and other person. And they know that that person will not do any spiritual practice to purify it. The Lama may use very wrathful means to make the karma come out now. And when the Lama used wrathful means to make the karma come out now, the Lama puts himself at risk to lose your respect, to lose your confidence, to lose your faith. But the Lama is willing to do that. Why? The Lama has no agenda to get something from you, to get money from you, to get your praise, to get your admiration. The Lama is out to save you. So if a Lama is afraid of how he looks when it comes to saving someone, he has an agenda. So Lamas in our country, such as Sarangji, that have no agenda, we can see clearly in their actions. They're very spontaneous, they're very wrathful, and they're very peaceful. It depends on the situation. Why? They have no agenda. They have no agenda to win your praise, win your confidence, or win you over in any short-term way. And even maybe you'll never meet the Lama again, but they remove that karma for you, so in the future, it'll manifest again that you can do Dharma somewhere else. There are many lamas that plant seeds in people's minds so that they know that during this time that person can practice Dharma. They plant seeds and they make prayers that when Maitreya Buddha manifests, their seeds are open, they can receive Dharma. Some lamas plant seeds for people a couple of thousand years later, a couple of hundred years later. Definitely. That was definitely. I know that because I know some lamas who told me very privately that they give initiation. Sometimes they give initiation to people, although they know the person's going to hell. Why? When they leave hell, they'll have the initiation seed so that they can do the Dharma. Whereas another person going to hell, they don't have the seeds at all. When they come out, empty-handed. Oh yes, I heard my guru's telling them, quietly. Of course, they don't tell the students because no student wants to know he's going to hell. I mean, if you say to the student, hey, you're going to go to hell, they say, you go to hell. These days, the students tell back the Lama, you go to hell. Last time you say, oh, what can I do, Lama? Times have been different. So therefore, some Lamas are very skillful. Some Lamas are very compassionate and very caring with zero agenda. And they're willing to put their reputation, their name, their learning, their status, who they are on the line by serving other people, by giving their money away, by scolding people, by listening to them, by staying up with them, by entertaining them, by giving them gifts. Why? The Lama has no agenda. Definitely not for himself. That's how you can check. So if you want to check your Lama before you take him as a Lama, that's how you check if he has an agenda. If the Lama is very, all the time in front of people, but behind he's a monster, then he has an agenda. If the Lama in front is a monster and behind is a monster, he doesn't hide that he's a monster, he has no agenda. Why is that? He's not protecting anything except you. So we label that what? A state that is less with ego or egolessness. Those methods are very powerful. If we're very, very fortunate, if we're very lucky, and I don't mean to be diplomatic in words, I mean it. If we're very lucky, we're very fortunate. If the Lama knows many negative things will happen to you, and they have so much love for you, the Lama may even beat you. The Lama might beat you and hurt you physically. And you may lose respect for the Lama or you may gain more faith. But definitely the Lama is purifying your karma. Why? The karma can manifest in any type of pain. Physical pain, humiliation pain, emotional pain, psychological pain, any type of pain. Why? That karma comes out faster. If we have a disease, it's easier to take it out when it's very new. If you let it take over your body, it's very difficult. So therefore the Lama's with no agendas, they're very kind. Chikun Trungpa, has no agenda. And therefore, in number two, he shows very unconventional methods. Why does he show unconventional methods? He has no agenda. He's not trying to impress you or to succor or to coddle your fears and your mind and your attachments. He's not trying to. So when he's not trying to coddle or to succor or to nurture your ego and to make it bigger, he uses what you call unconventional crazy wisdom. Why is it unconventional and crazy? It's crazy because one culture feels another culture's actions is crazy. Hindu sadhus who penetrate their bodies with spears and ropes and all that stuff, we call them crazy. When we don't do that to show an act of devotion, they call us crazy. So crazy is from a reference point from which you are born. Crazy is culturally conceived. Culturally conceived. So in this culture, I think if you eat dogs, they think you're crazy and disgusting. If you go to Vietnam, you don't eat dogs, they wonder what's wrong with you. So it's culturally conceived. Culturally conceived. In this society here, if you live with your mother, even you're 40 or 50, it's all right as long as you're not married. But in America, if you live with your mother or father after you're 18, you're crazy. And your parents are crazy. And you hear that all the time. You hear parents tell the parents, your kid's already 18, you still have him in the house, you're destroying your life, you're crazy. Or kids or peers to tell their children, their other peers, you still live with mom and you're 18? Like, grow up, get a life? But here, they say, oh, you're single, you don't live with your mom, and you're 45? Why not? So which one is right? Which one is wrong? What's my point? If we come from this culture, we go to America, it looks odd and crazy to us. When we come to this, when we go from that culture to here, we look at it as very odd. Both have benefits and disbenefits. One is not better than the other. I'm not being diplomatic. Think about it. Think about it. There are people who never grow up who should live with their mom for the rest of their lives. Unfortunate for them. And there are people who are grown up who can do much more if they don't live with their moms their whole life and go under their protective wings. They have talents themselves. So it's not right or wrong. Similarly, when we say crazy wisdom, it's crazy because we're at this level, operating from this level, operating from this reference point, at that level. So when we operate at that level, and someone is judging from this level, they will call it crazy. Why? Because this person has no agenda. This person does. So to operate from no agenda, perceived by an agenda-crazed person, the agenda-less person, is crazy. It's very simple. It's very, very simple. So we say, well, if you put us in a very difficult predicament, you Tibetan Rinpoches, you put us really in a very difficult predicament, then you tell us to check our lamas before we hook up with them. Yes. How do we check if we're here and they're there? By their students. By their long-term actions, by what they do for their monasteries and their organization, how much they can give up for others, how much time, energy, sleep, love, care, finances, reputation they can give up for others, how much they can give for others, you can see the result matches the person's motivation. So we can't examine the gurus. I certainly can't go run around examining some high guru to see if he's pure or not, but I look at the actions. I look at his residence, I look at his people, I look at what he does, I look at his possessions, I look at how he acts, and if he's totally obnoxious and loud and whatever, I'll look at what's the effect of the students later on to them. Even if some students have run away, do they have regrets? Do they still love the Lama? How do they feel? Then we know the Lama's motivation. We know, that's how we examine. So how do we examine a Lama before we accept a person as a Lama? By the result of the person's action. To examine directly, you will have to be at that level or higher. At that level or higher. So if you're not at that level or higher, you're not able to examine, so you're confused. But if you're at a higher level or equal level, you can examine. So therefore, that's why I say here, We shouldn't criticize lamas. We shouldn't criticize lineages. We shouldn't criticize teachers and practices and centers. Why? We're not at the level to criticize. And if other people criticize, are they at the level? How do you know if they're at the level, how much they have sacrificed in their lives? Are they monks? Are they nuns? Are they meditating? Are they in retreat? Are they learning? Are they devoted? What do they spend their actions on? So that if they're not at the level to criticize, and they criticize, and you believe them, you're at their level too. So that's why it's very important in spiritual practice, particularly in Buddhism, to use our eyes, to use our ears, and input the information, and then use our brain, not to depend on other people. Why? Other people may be as ignorant as us. As us. Totally. They can be as ignorant as us. Ignorant doesn't mean they're bad. It means they don't know. So when they don't know, and they blabber on, and they talk on, and they criticize on and on and on, they can be potentially taking you away from something that can be a potential benefit to you and many other beings. So what's important is, since we can't examine into the person's mind and action, we can check, person's mind and motivation, we can check their action. So we don't have to talk about a lama or a dharma teacher, which is kind of beyond our scope. But we can talk about myself, I can talk about another person. We can check the other person, what activity they're very interested in. And for most cases, their body shape, the discipline of their body, their physical appearance, the way they dress their clothes, their house if we get to see, how neat or unneat, their cars, how they drive, how they focus. All these things we can see into another person because that's the result of their mind to see what level they are at. Very cute. I'm not asking you to be judgmental. I'm using that as an example, logically, to tell another person's state of mind. So the person's consistently overweight, consistently, due to that, they're unhealthy, or they become lazy. That shows you clearly their mind that they don't exert any type of six paramita effort. Zero effort. Sometimes they have a family problem of obese or whatever. That's different. I'm talking about normal. If some people are very attracted to gossip, very attractive. Maybe you tell them something negative, they're very interested. But if you tell them something positive, they're not interested. It tells you the level of their mind. What is the level of their mind? They don't judge or come to conclusions based on facts, based on information, or based on research, because they don't apply the effort to know more. But they base their conclusions on hearsay and gossip. And therefore, if they do that, they bring harm to themselves and others. Why? If they can gossip about others, they create the karma that others will gossip about them. When others gossip about them and say negative things about them, they cannot cry or be sad and say, I misunderstood. Nobody understands me. Why do they say that about me? Because you create the karma for them by being that same way. And if we gossip about someone or something that's higher level than us, in this case, like a high lama, or reincarnation, or a great master, the karma is even more powerful to come back to us. Why? Let me give you logic. If you slap a dog, it's very bad. You slap a monk, it's even worse. If you slap the Buddha, the karma is even higher. So therefore, if the object in which we do negative actions to creates the level of karma that we get, definitely, if we criticize high teachers and high masters, it's very dangerous. It's very dangerous. Why is that? If we can make offerings to Kuan Yin, and we get blessings, as opposed to making offerings to a dog, if we make offerings to a dog, we get some good karma. But if we make offerings to Kuan Yin, we collect merit, and the merit is much greater because of the object. So if we give an apple to a dog, or we give an apple to Kuan Yin, since the result is different, if we do negative actions to them, the result will be different also. Very different. So therefore, if we lose confidence due to our laziness, inability to push ourselves, and hiding, and more ego-filling toxic actions. And we lose confidence in the three jewels or our lamas or our practice. It's very dangerous. Why is that very dangerous? It's self-inflicted danger. Why is it self-inflicted danger? Because self-inflicted danger, because we didn't put in the energy to gain confidence and gain faith. We didn't put in the energy to actually bring ourselves to the next level. So then we lose out. So therefore, if we can make offerings to Kuan Yin and to the high monks to have our wishes fulfilled, if we criticize them, the karma is even stronger. So therefore, if you hear people criticizing lamas and teachers and masters, if you hear them, if you have the wisdom and you have the mind and the learning, many years of learning and study and meditation, to debate with them politely, to change their minds, engage. Because why? If you keep quiet, you are a part of it. But if you don't have the wisdom and you don't have the study and the learning and your knowledge is based on gossip and you debate, you might follow them. You might even become their group. And that's very dangerous. Why is that? You lose out. So a person who is used to coming to conclusions with facts, with examination, with logic, with thinking, they will apply that in all areas of their life. That's what we call a person who's intelligent. The person who does it on gossip, we call them shallow. Superficial. Why? They don't want to exert their energy into thinking deeper. So they're shallow. They're superficial. And therefore, their mind will go this way when someone says something. Then when someone says something else, it goes this way. Then it goes this way and this way. In the end, they're alone. They're alone. Why are they alone? Because they never confirm here or there or there or here. They don't confirm. As Ganjirimji said recently in Thailand, we met him 2 weeks ago, approximately. If we cultivate beauty, if we cultivate outside beauty, physical appearance, it lasts us a short while. But if we're not beautiful inside, people go away, even if we're beautiful on the outside. But if we cultivate inner beauty, we put the time to cultivate that through the Dharma. If we're beautiful on the outside and beautiful on the inside, he said it's a double plus. But if we're not beautiful on the outside and we're beautiful on the inside, people will follow us. So beauty is initial attraction. They're like, oh wow, you're beautiful. That's a beautiful girl. That's a beautiful man. Oh wow, I want to know you better. But when you talk to them and they're shallow, they're bimbos, they're gossipy, they don't know much, they're interested in their hair, their makeup, and their muscles, and they're just interested in their sports car. They're very shallow. They're very bimbo-like. No matter how beautiful they are, you get bored very, very fast. Very, very fast. And that proves that even without Dharma, what the Dharma is telling us is the truth. How our eyes look, how our body looks, how our face looks, and our body actions will send a message to the other person very quickly. What kind of person we are. So in Dharma, when we learn these things, it's very helpful. Do you know why it's very helpful? If we are embarrassed about them, then we know we are guilty. Some people react in embarrassment by being more humble and saying, I'm going to do something. Some people react in embarrassment by telling off the teacher or fighting the teacher because they don't like what the teacher has said and they want to put the teacher down. So if they put the teacher down, they're right, but actually they're not right. Some people cover their embarrassment by arrogance, silence, kind of fold their hands, they kind of look like I don't care, they kind of just sit back and say, you know, it's not me. But that's all cover-ups. Why? If we feel embarrassed, we should take a positive action. What's the positive action? To do something about it. To do something. That's how our teachers approached us in the monasteries, that the teachers told us. You see, how we learn in the monasteries is different than here, but what we learn is not different. What we learn is not different. How we approach the Dharma here and in the monastery is different, but the result and the motivation is not different. Is not different. So therefore, lamas, high lamas, can manifest incredible crazy wisdom. Why is it crazy? You say, well, why would a lama act like that, embarrass himself? Because he loves you so much. Why doesn't that lama act the way I feel a lama should act? Because you're so attached to the way a person should act. That's why the lama doesn't act that way. To break your attachment. If the Lama is like that all the time, he would be like that with every person. With every single person, he would be like that. How come he's selective in who he's like that with? Selective. If he's selective in who he acts with like that, crazy or loud, it means he's training. If the Lama's like that with everybody, then he's not training, he's like that. If you go to a crazy house, no matter who comes to the crazy person, they're going to act crazy to you. You can be the president, you can be the prime minister, you can be the most beautiful lady, you can be a bum on the street, they react to you the same way they would react. But if a person reacts differently to the other person, two conclusions. Either they have an agenda, or they don't have an agenda. Isn't that tricky? So if a person acts differently with different people, either they have an agenda, or they don't have an agenda, a bad motive. Agenda is bad motivation. It's very tricky. So how do we look at that? Let's go deeper. By seeing the results of the actions, long term. We check the Lama's motivation. Is the Lama surrounding himself with luxury and wealth? Is the Lama surrounding himself with jewels and lots of money for himself? Is the Lama surrounding himself with beautiful houses and beautiful women and beautiful everything that you have? Or is the Lama trying to surround himself with Dharma? Dharma objects, Dharma items, Dharma people, Dharma motivation, Dharma work, Dharma projects. That's how we check. So the Lama is always talking about Dharma projects and Dharma work and Dharma motivation and moving you dharmically and talking about Dharma all the time. He must be without an agenda. But if he lets you be who you are and as you are, and he doesn't even move one inch to change you or transform you because you're giving him things that he likes, he has an agenda. Why? He's afraid to upset his rightful. Very logical. A little blatant, a little too open, but no one has ever said that Tsenramchi is diplomatic. I've never ever heard that negative comment. Tsenramchi is very diplomatic. Oh, he's very, very diplomatic. He's an emanation of Joseph Chan. He's very diplomatic. I never heard that. You see, if lamas cannot manifest anger and wrath, then you better tell all the wrathful deities to throw in the towel. Yeah. You tell Vajrayana Yamataka, I don't understand why you're so pissed off and you scare us like that. Can you take a hike? You better tell. And next time we go see Setra, we cover his face and say, I don't like the way you look, but help me. How silly. If the deities can manifest wrathful expressions, definitely the lamas will take on those personalities to transform the person. Why? You need an ambassador of wrath between the wrathful deity and yourself. You need an ambassador. What do you think? Yamataka emanates in a gentle little nun, smiling, hitting a fish drum. Namo Amitabha, don't hit people, don't be mean to people, don't run away, don't be a lazy bum. Om mani padme hum, mani padme hum. No. Yamataka manifests its energy. It slaps you around and tells you off. You want to sponsor him or not? He don't care. You want to hang around and help him or not? He don't care. You want to gossip about him? He don't care. Why? Maybe he cares about you more. Maybe. Maybe. So ambassadors of Kuan Yin Yang, they show up looking like Ben over here. All nice and smiley and sweet. And fabulous. Ambassadors of Ajigini who are funky and wild and obnoxious, Paris. Yeah, there's nothing wrong. Because they're all Buddhists. Ambassadors of Manjushri or someone like Andy, who's got the eloquence of speech. He does speak well, and he does write very well. In fact, I'm amazed at his writing. I was talking about it with one of the liaisons last night. Amazed. Oh, yes. So you have ambassadors of different types of energies. So we don't stop questioning. And then we say, well, I'm not ready for that energy. How do you know you're not ready? How do you know? If you know you're ready or not ready, that means you know more than the Buddhas. You know more. If you know more, why do you need to take refuge? Have the Buddhas come and take refuge for you. Give Shakyamuni his new refuge name. Give Tsongkhapa his new refuge name. Because you know more than them, so you give them refuge. And then you send Setra to the corner and tell him to calm down and have a glass of milk before he comes for refuge. I mean, how ridiculous. There's nothing to understand because you're not at the level to understand. There's only examination of the result. There's only examination of self. Are these tricky words? No. I'm not telling one person in a room without recording. I'm being recorded all over the world. I've got plenty of people in this room, and most of you are intelligent. Most. Who can say, wait a minute, there's something wrong there. And most of you are awake. Most. So if I'm going to tell you in a room secretly, you know, I give you a drink, and after you drink the drink, you're kind of sleepy, you don't know why. Then you say, wait a minute, there's something wrong here. I'm saying it openly, in front of everybody. It goes all over the world. It gets broadcasted everywhere. So if there's something wrong, you're going to get a bombardment of emails. I'm not afraid of what I'm saying. I'm confident. Why am I confident? I watched my mind trick itself that way. I've seen my other friends' mind trick themselves. And I have a lot of friends, not even in this country, outside, that you guys may know or not know about. And some of them are very desperate situations these days, very desperate, where they've actually gone back to their countries and went back to square one. All the things that their Lama told them to do, they didn't do. Recently, I met one of my Lamas. He told me, we were talking about this one student, and a student had to go all the way back to their country and go back to study and go back to work and go back to live with his mother. He's already in his mid-40s. And when I talked about it with my Lama, my Lama says, yeah, that's exactly what I told him to do many years ago. To study, and then he would be in a different situation now. He didn't listen. So my point is this, is that how we gain confidence in the Dharma path, how we gain confidence in our Dharma teacher, how do we gain confidence to know they have no agenda? How do we know they don't have agenda? They act differently than us. They're not diplomatic. They don't tell us nice words. And they are different with different people. They are straightforward. They don't mind how it looks on their reputation. I'm not praising those qualities. I am asking you to look at that as symptoms of a person with no agenda. That's what I'm saying. So therefore, during Chögyam Trungpa's holy life, people didn't call him a mahasiddha. They didn't call him a legend. They reported him to immigration as he read his book. They criticized him. They said many nasty things about him. They didn't like him. Many people against him. And I know many people who have left him, because I've met some people in Los Angeles who left Chögyam Trungpa and said, we don't understand his crazy ways. No, they didn't say that. We don't understand his ways. But now they regret. Why do they regret? Because when Chögyam Trungpa has died, his work has grown. His work has benefited so many even after his death. They call him a mahasiddha. They didn't call him a mahasiddha when he was alive. They call him a disrobed disgrace to Tibetan Buddhism. A disrobed disgrace. And during that generation, 30 years or 40 years ago, they were even more conservative than now. Now I can go to the app and say, oh, blah, 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 blah. That's why I'm dressed like that. They go, okay, not bad. You explain. Last time, there's no room for explanation. None. None at all. In fact, there was a saying in Ganden. There was a saying. Once he's disrobed, tatavis means he's finished. Now they say he's disrobed, oh, we hope he continues to do Dharma work. They'll say that now. Why? Because time and people have changed completely. So what do we do? What's important is this. Is it's not whether a person's robed or disrobed, or dresses this way, or looks this way, or acts this way, or fits your concept of what a Lama should be. And which of you has been to Tibet? Which of you stayed in the monastery? Which of you actually knows how a Lama should act? Which one of you has spent the time and energy to be able to come to that position, to even say it? Even the great Lamas don't criticize other Lamas, although they know what's right and wrong. So, we have to check if the person has an agenda. And the agenda is positive or negative before we take on the commitment to the Lama, not after. We don't marry our wife and then check her out. We check her out before we marry. We don't check our husbands out before we marry. Then after we marry him, we find out he's a big loser. We have to check them out before we marry them. If after we marry them, we're stuck. We're pretty much stuck. So we need to work on it. It might be our karma. So therefore, how come some people with a little bit of criticism, they flutter away? How come some people you can scream and shout at them after year after year, they gain more faith in the Lama? Must be the, not the Lama, must be the level of the person. So the level person says, oh, I'm not at that level. That's a cop-out. Why is that a cop-out? That you don't love people around you. You don't love yourself. You don't love anyone. Why don't you love them? Because you're ready to escape from facing yourself. That's the truth. That's what my Lama told me. That's what Tenzin Rinpoche used to tell me before. I used to go to his room and complain and bitch and tell him everything that was wrong in the world and all my disillusionment. I was very disillusioned many times. I was very disillusioned many times. There was one time out of the many times I was disillusioned. The good thing about me is I didn't jump out of the Dharma. I stayed in it, although I was disillusioned. One time I was very disillusioned that I have a great altar. I covered the whole altar up with a sheet. The whole thing. So that's it. I'm going to look at the Buddhas. I'm going to look at Tsongkhapa. I'm going to look at my gurus. I'm going to look at sovereignty. Sorry. I'm not going to look at any of this. I covered it up and I didn't make any offerings and it was a protest. Really? That's it. I didn't remove them yet because I wasn't sure if I want to go that far. But I covered them up. I wouldn't make offerings. For me, not making offerings is a very big, big deal because I have a thing for offerings. Very big. So I covered them all up. No, that's it. And I said to them through the covers, I'm not afraid to you anymore. I'm not going to study anymore, and I'm not going to learn anymore, and I'm not going to do this anymore because you don't help me at all. I'm still suffering. And I'm so unhappy. These people are doing these things to me, and you're not helping at all. Any of you. There's so many of you. There's just one of me. Why does anybody help? Does anybody listen? Yeah, I was saying, and I said a lot of nasty things to them. I can't remember now, but it was along that line to cover them up. One day went by. I was very adamant. No, I was just very adamant. The second day went by, I was very strong. I was like, I'm right. The third day went by, I'm totally right. Then I went for my teacher's teachings. You see, because although I was disillusioned and I was unhappy with my teacher at that time, and with the practice and me not having results, I still loved him. Because I saw all the benefits he brought. So I went for the teachings and I listened and my mind changed. After the teachings, I went back to my room and I was thinking how to make up. I was. You know, like when you break up with your girlfriend, you think, okay, you know you're wrong. You don't know what to say or what to do and you want her to come begging. You want your partner to come begging, but actually, you want to say something but you can't because you feel so stupid. So it was like that. I was looking at them thinking, so who talks to who first? Now, how do I resurrect my practice? How do I go back to my practice? And I did do my sadness for 3 days. Oh my God, that's very big for me. 3 or 4 days. So I was a kid, I was about 18, 19. I lifted up the covers and I went like that, are you good? I did an asthma there because the pictures are empty. I thought the enlightened beings already floated away. So I just went, are you guys still there? And I removed everything. And I looked at them and I folded my hands and I said, I'm sorry. I did that. I said, I'm sorry to them. Yes, I'm a Rinpoche and I do that too. Sorry to disappoint you. You came to see a living Buddha. In fact, you came upon a living fart. What to do? Well, at least I'm honest. I tell you I'm not a living Buddha. I'm not. So I lifted the covers and I looked at them and I said, I'm sorry. I cleaned it up. I sat down and did my sadhana, I think 3 or 4 times to make up for the days that I missed. And I was crying quite a lot. I cried quite a lot. You know why I cried? I'm not going to give you this kind of religious fervor. Oh, they were always there. They're in me. They're around. I just didn't see them. No. You know what I realized? Is I didn't overcome the qualities in me that treat people and things and objects that don't fulfill my wishes. I didn't change. So when I want something, when I expect something, when I need something, when I feel I need something, and I don't get it, and I don't fulfill my expectation, I need to take it on. And I even went to the level of taking it out on the Buddhas. That's what I realized. So I'm not going to tell you, oh, I opened up. They were always there. That's so tired. You know, you hear religious people say that, you know, oh, they were always there, and I just found God. You found God. You find four-leaf clovers, and you find coins on the street, you don't find God. And then they say something like, oh, God was always there. I'm like, where? Show me. So Buddha is always there. Show me where. But Buddha is when I let go, when I come to terms with myself, when I realize that I am the one who needs to do something about the way I feel, because I'm not happy about the way I feel, and I need to apply the right remedy to the way I feel, not the wrong or immediate remedy that's right in front of me. And that's what I realized at that time. When I was in Gangnam, I ran away several times. Several times. I packed up my bags and left in the middle of the night. I said, that's it. I'm tired of the poverty. I'm tired of the mosquitoes. I'm tired of no water. I'm tired of no electricity. I'm tired of going to classes. I'm tired of not understanding the classes. I'm tired of the classes going on for hours and hours and my legs are killing me. I'm tired of not getting enough sleep. Oh, yes. Over there, you know, because I have insomnia, so I can't sleep till around 2, 3 a.m. We got to get up at 5 a.m. for pujas every day. Every day for years, and I couldn't stand it. The lack of sleep. I suffered tremendously. And sometimes the pujas are 2 or 3 times and all day long. You know, separate pujas in Gangnam are 2 full days. They start somewhere around 5 o'clock in the morning, and they finish somewhere at 11 o'clock at night. 2 days every month. All day. You have a lunch break, of course. You go take a nap for 2 hours. All day. And it's every month. So I love Setra, but I hate the mornings. I love the pujas, but I hate the mornings. My guru was the abbot. I used to say, can't you just change it? Can't we have pujas in the evening? What's the difference? I used to tell him, there's no light in the morning, there's no light at dark, so it's the same one. If you guys are into, you know, doing pujas in the dark or starting in the dark, I told him. He looked at me like, practice the Dharma. I used to tell him that, you know, we go through the pujas, it's all dark. And when we leave the pujas, it's dark. So why don't we just start at night and finish in the morning before the sun comes out? What's the difference? He just said to me, you're crazy. He doesn't even want to justify that ridiculous comment because it's all ego. It's me trying to adjust everything for me. I did that in the monastery. I ran away 2-3 times. I was caught. I was caught by the monk police. Brought back, dragged back, bags and all, to my guru. Yeah, and my guru, I would be scared to walk into the room. I'd be so scared. I'd be trembling. You know why I was scared? Because I know what I'm doing. Deep down inside. I'm trying to run away. Yeah, I'm trying to run away. I was scared. I know Kenshin is just going to scream at me, but he's not going to scream at me. He does scream at me. He screams at me very loud. Very loud. You can hear the neighbors. And I'm a Rinpoche. I'm getting screamed at. How can a Rinpoche be wrong? Uh-oh. Big ego time. He needs to scream at me really, really loud. And I'd be like, oh no. All the neighbors know. So when I go to puja the next day, when I walk up, they all look at me like. And they tell other monks. They tell my other friends. They say, he got screamed at him. And they tell them the details. And I'm like, you're a monk, keep quiet. Everybody knows. Tenrinji got screamed at, Tenrinji got screamed at, ni. What can I tell Tenrinji about them? But of course it never works. Tenrinji is not stupid, I couldn't manipulate it. Sometimes I go to Tenrinji and say, oh, guess what I heard about that monk? He says, who cares? He say to me, who cares? Do your sadhana. I go, okay, but don't you want to know that your students, don't you care? He says, of course I care, that's why I'm doing my sadhana. I go, oh dear, let me go back to my room, it didn't work again. Well, yeah, I know all these things, I can teach you so well, because I'm a holy living Buddha. No, I did it myself. I did it myself. I tried all types of tricks to escape my ego, escape my responsibilities. Don't think I went to Gangnam and I just stayed there and I was all holy schmoly and I came out here to Malaysia and I'm the living Buddha. I tried to run away from Gangnam many times. And I'll talk about that in my bark many times. I thought about it countless times and I found out I'm not the only monk who tried to run away or thought about running away. It's really hard. It's really, really hard. But the good thing is I stayed. I guess my spiritual commitment and conviction was stronger than I thought. Never went back to the United States. Left in 87. Did not go back until now. It represents everything I left behind. There's a lot of things I miss in the States. I don't want to live there, but there's a lot of things I miss. But I think to myself, never mind. Sometimes when I'm in Malaysia, I miss the United States, even now. Some kind of cultural aspect, some kind of ways of expression, and the way people act and stuff, I miss that. I miss it very much, but I think, okay, never mind. I go back there, what happens? I enjoy it for 2-3 weeks, and I come back here, it's the same thing. I also control my mind. So what happens is this, is that how am I able to lucidly explain all these things to you, that I'm some high lama looking down on you? No. I am you. I am you. I think like you. I have the same problems as you. The only difference is because I'm given the name Rinpoche, and I'm thrown robes, and I'm given a throne, and I'm shown respect, I'm not allowed to act like other people. I'm supposed to act like it doesn't affect me. You guys have that option. You can jump out there and scream and shoot people in the university, 32 of them to be exact. You can do whatever you want and it's all right. But the minute Temrimji even slurps when he drinks, he's not enlightened at all. He's just a slob. Because I have a name and I have a title. But I'm not allowed to be ordinary. Why am I not allowed to be ordinary? Because everybody has a projection. Everybody has a thought of how a Rinpoche should be. If we talked to everybody in this room and interviewed them separately, alone, without listening to another peer, they would have a different version of how Rinpoche should act. Some people say, hey, it's no problem. You know, it's no problem. Rinpoche can go to disco with me and hang out. We can dance and he's still enlightened. I can go to Dharma teaching. Some people say, oh no. No, he needs to sit on the throne and live on there and stay there and meditate on there and camp out there and sleep there and also teach us there. Just stay on the throne. Never get off. That's what Rinpoche is supposed to be. And some people be like, well, we can have both. Some people say, oh, Rinpoche has hair. What do you think Rinpoche don't have hair follicles on? Oh, does that mean he's not qualified because he has hair? But the other Rinpoches we saw didn't have hair. Maybe they were bald, I don't know. Oh, does that mean that if he has hair, he can't teach? Or he teaches less? You have hair, does that mean you're less than who you are if you don't have hair? He doesn't wear the robes. You wear the robes in Malaysia. You've been around Malaysia wearing 15 meters of maroon robes, and let's see what happens to you. You look like a fat Indian woman with a maroon sari. They ask, what's going on? Hare Krishna. There's nothing wrong. But what's the type of people you're trying to penetrate? What's the type of people you're trying to talk to? If you're in robes, you better make sure your students know how to serve you correctly. They know how to drive you correctly. They know how to set up your throne. They know how to make your arrangements. Because you're in robes, you can't do anything yourself. Why? If you do anything, the minute you see a monk in a shopping mall, consumerism. So you got to make sure your students are not blurred. They go to the shopping center buying the right cottage cheese. And sometimes lamas are incredible. Sometimes lamas will use food and very simple ways to train up your students. Sometimes they'll send them out many times to get the same food for different foods. They're not attached to money, they're not attached to their house, they're not attached to themselves, they're not attached to anything, but suddenly they're attached to food. So people who have higher intelligence think, how come he only does that to one person or two people, not me? And then other times he's not, how can someone be attached to food and nothing else? That's ridiculous. And is your lama 350 pounds? 400 kgs? Koki looks at himself. Yeah, I saw him, he looked at himself and said that. Well, how can that be? Maybe he's checking the attitude of that person out and how they work and how they operate. Maybe. You mean Lama's crazy? Definitely not. See, the Lama has to do one action that fulfills the needs of everyone. He has to do something that fulfills the needs of most people. And there's going to be some people who are disgruntled. It's always like that. Why? Level. Skill and the Lama and the perceiver. If the perceiver's level is very high, everything will be perfect. If the perceiver's side is very low, everything will be questionable. From the Lama's side, if the Lama's level is high, everything he does still can be questioned. Imagine Buddha Shakyamuni walking up and down Bukit-Bintang begging for food these days to be arrested. Not allowed anymore. Can you imagine Buddha opening up a retreat center in a rubber plantation, no license? Restrictions for building statues and all that? Of course. Maybe slapped with the same thing. Imagine Buddha today standing up saying, I'm a Buddha. They say, yeah, right, get a life. Times have changed. Methods have changed. Lamas who are willing to change their methods like Chögyam Trungpa. Lamas who are willing to change their outlook, their robes, their criteria, how they talk, how they act. They are very kind. You know why they're very kind? They risk their own reputation and life and riceful to bring the Dharma to people who ordinarily not be touched. And the people who criticize will be people who don't fit that style. And their level is to criticize. But definitely people who benefit. I'm telling you, I've heard about him when I was in America many years ago. I've heard nothing but nasty things. Nothing. When I was on the Dharma circuit in Los Angeles, I was at the center there. I heard nothing but nasty things about Chögyam Trungpa. Nothing.
I never heard one good thing. And I'm not going to repeat what I heard because it's very, very bad. Over and over, and people actually said, don't go to him. You know, people are running away from on and on and on. And now I'm studying about him. Now I fold my hands when I read about him. Sometimes it brings a tear to my eye.
But it wasn't like that 30 years ago. I never criticized him either, because I know ex-students of this. I know them. So my point is this, is I am not promoting him because I have reached this level. I am not saying he's wonderful because I'm a little chip off the old block. On some levels, I have seen through what he is doing through 30 years of being a dominant experience. 30 years. I've seen through. Not all, because I'm not at that level, but I've seen through. I've seen through much more than many people here, if I may say so with respect. Much more. So I've seen through. And therefore, I can accept. I don't accept because I'm disillusioned. I don't accept because I don't have anything smart to say. I accept because I have seen through. And some more, his actions has proven beneficial to many, to many. So therefore, usually these kind of beings are not considered legends in their own time, or they're wonderful, or they're monsters. Actually, usually when they pass away, even in Christian tradition, someone like Joan of Arc was only granted sainthood many years after her death. Even Mother Teresa still under observation. Many years. But during their lifetimes, no. When Mother Teresa first did her things, if you read her book, it was totally out of the question. Nobody accepted. There was no such order, no such thing. It went through many years of proving that she got the folks' approval, many years. She's very kind at that time. But my point is, in the Chinese tradition, you have Zai Kong. Nobody thought he was a monastic during his life. Now people make statues of him, worship him, and say he's an emanation of Avalokiteshvara. Because why? He dared to be different. I like that style. I'm not like them. I'm not like Mother Teresa and Zai Kong, that kind of level of spiritual maturation. But I like that style. Do you know why? I like it when she came from but through, peed all over Akonamji's altar. I liked it. I liked it very much. Because that's something I would like to do, but not around here. You don't pee on Malaysians' altars. You're lucky if they pee back on you, they call the police on you. But in America, you can get away with it. In Scotland, you can get away with it. Well, I don't know, whatever. It's his way of expressing art. Different over there. So, I like that kind of directness. I like that kind of energy. I like it very much because one thing that bothers me very much about others and myself that really, really disturbs me the core. Let me tell you a secret, is hiding behind a facade, pretending that people don't know who you really are or how you really are, or trying to use all types of games and words and explanations to cover who you really are when it's so clear to see. That really bothers me. And some people do that for years and years and years. I know some people who do that with me for over decades. They'll still cover up. They'll still not change and transform. So for those people, there's nothing left but wrathful actions. Why? Death is very near. Death is not far. So you have to use actions to help them before it's too late. Why? Peaceful means didn't work anymore. And that's the compassion of a Lama. How does that happen? Because whatever you manifest to them is at the Lama's own expense. So the Lama's willing to accept the expenses behind that kind of wrathful action in order to help that being. There's nothing to understand or not understand. It is a method. Why is there that method? Because they're that type of beings. There's that type of beings.